Welcome to the LSE and to this event on Aicha Chibukchu's wonderful new book, For the Love of Humanity, The World Tribunal on Iraq. This event is part of, I have to read text that I've been given, forms part of the New World Disorders series held in the run-up to the LSE Festival, a week-long series of events taking place from 25 February to 2 March, free to attend and open to all, exploring how social science can tackle global issues. How did we get here, indeed? What are the challenges, and importantly, how can we address them? The full program is available online. One note, if you hear a loud bell, run out the door you came and keep running out into Houghton Street. So that's the end of the preliminaries. I am Professor Tariq Barkawi in the International Relations Department, and I'm here just as the chair. This is Aicha Chibukchu, who is the author of the book, Tor Creever, who is one of the speakers, Professor Kimberly Hutchins from Queen Mary, Professor David Graeber from LSE, Dr. Lori Allen from SOAS, and Haifa. Thank you. Do you have a university affiliation?
Not at all.
That's excellent. No. You're very happy about that.
I am the odd one out.
Aicha's book presents itself as an ethnography of the World Tribunal on Iraq, which was an effort of the anti-war movement against the Iraq War to replicate something that had been done in the Vietnam War. But that is a deceptive, sort of simple explanation of it. It's a wonderful combination of ethnography, political theory, international law, and straight-up good political thinking. And it explores the tensions involved in trying to develop an anti-imperialism through universal conception of human rights. So that's by way of introduction. Speaking first will be Haifa Zangana, then Lori Allen, then Tor Creever, Dr. Tor Creever. I stole your PhD earlier.
No.
Oh, not yet. Oh, they've given it to you here. Wow, then Mr. and then Professor Graeber, and then Professor Hutchins will finish us off. The speakers will go between 5 and 10 minutes. I'll shut them off violently at 10 minutes, and we'll have plenty of time for questions and back and forth between the audience and the panel. I think, with no further ado, off to you.
Well, yeah, thank you very much, and congratulations, Aicha. This is... I think it's a very significant book because, to start with, it does document and record something we thought it was a dream at that time. And we are activists, and I consider myself an activist. We are very bad at recording. Usually we just act and forget about it and nothing being recorded or documented. So it is an important document. I see it this way. There are a few things. I mean, one of the chapters was fantastic, especially at the occasion of the World Tribunal, which I attended myself. And by the way, there were 12 sessions, probably Aicha will talk about later, 12 sessions of the World Tribunal in various countries around the world. I had the chance to attend 4 or 5 of them, I think. It was in Belgium, in Tokyo, other cities around the world. The chapter which she wrote about the final, the World Tribunal in Istanbul, it's really worth reading, if not for the analysis and the documentation and the argument, but also for the beauty of writing. For me, it was sheer poetry. It is something fascinating about the style of writing, how to transfer you from this world to that place where we were all together dreaming of achieving something beyond the reality of the war and the occupation, as well as all the kind of crimes. So this is really something should be read as a piece almost of poetry, where she transfers us from history to the day activities at that time. One point which Aicha mentioned in particular, and probably not enough attention paid, was the participation of Iraqis. And as you by now guessed, I am an Iraqi myself, and I've been there. So it's the role of the Iraqis themselves within the founding meeting really was, I don't know if there was one person or none at all at that. So to establish the World Tribunal, Iraqis themselves were not involved, though they are belonging to the country that's been occupied. It was a normal participation. At later stages, when it's like been around the world from one place to another, the role of Iraq is almost again, except maybe for a few cases, it was the role of either eyewitnesses or expert witnesses. So I was an expert witness within this. There was no, in fact, hardly any role into justifying or into working on the theory or analysis or something, very hardly. This is not because Aisha chose selectively not to mention, but actually we were living as Iraqis at that time, we were in shock. We were suddenly the occupied. We were a group of people, some of us never met each other. Some of us were in exile, living there for 30 years, 25 years, others that just managed to get out from Iraq. And they got out of Iraq with great difficulties. We didn't know each other. The gap between us was big. So it was something like 30 years of different kind of life altogether. Iraqis inside Iraq, they were under the dictatorship, but as well as under the embargo, a complete cutoff almost of the outside world. We were different kind of people, almost. So getting there, while all the sessions taking places, while the World Tribunal going on, the arguments about the legality, non-legality, everything going, we didn't have that luxury at all. We didn't get involved even, because we were very busy trying to know each other. We were on the fringe in the end. So that was very, very important point, which I've noticed in the book, but that is not a shortcoming of the book itself. It was something. And Aisha mentioned that a lot of things needs to be reflected on, and I think this is something which we as Iraqis who have been involved there, and I think our number was something like 10 to 15 people all together, due to difficulty of getting visas, getting people inside for the tribunal itself. The final session was while everybody came from around Europe, America, everywhere else. Iraqis were, some of them who came from inside Iraq were arrested and they were imprisoned in Turkey on the border, and we had to work to release them and all the stuff. So they were also risking their lives at that time, coming outside Iraq, trying. Our role was mainly, I mean, while we weren't involved in the analysis and thinking about the human rights, about democracy, about the change, and all those important issues that we should have thought about, but what we were really thinking about at that time is how to survive, how to help Iraqis to survive. It's the basic needs. We were down to the bottom. Absolutely to the bottom, how to record, trying our best to record the crimes that committed daily and the atrocities committed. Fallujah was happening, taking place, the destruction taking place, the depleted uranium being used, and some of it being taken, I mean, like in various sessions being dealt with all these topics and the thing. I think the other point that's worth pointing in the book, which I've noticed and I read it very carefully, is many of the arguments there about philosophers, thinkers, lawyers, international law experts and all went about the regime change. It's about the war, the legality of the war. Like, I mean, I just quote Habermas' Reflects on the War in Iraq. I quote, "The liberation of a brutalized population from a barbaric regime is a great good among political goods. It is the greatest of all." So that's one point being, actually, Aisha was arguing, having this. But also, I mean, through the whole argument about the philosophy of the war, about justification of the war, nothing has been mentioned at all about how it's been manufactured, about how this brutal regime being manufactured, whether it's through the media or it's through the arms suppliers or through various interest in the Middle East. So these are very important points, because at a later stage, as you all know, as we all know, that so many things came to the surface and it proved that they were lies. There were complete fabrications, if not mostly fabrications. Weapons of mass destruction, the brutality of the regime, to what extent, the mass graves all been questioned about it, what media was covering what, and the whole thing. Though, I mean, in the charges at the final session of the World Tribunal, it being one of the charges charging the media about the fabrication, but it wasn't there through arguing of the idea of philosopher, of the empires, of the laws, of everything else came through the book. There wasn't anything about questioning those people when they went to justify the war for the benefits of the people who are under a brutal regime is how this process of, which we know in the case of Iraq, it's been started from the 90s continuously until 2003, if not more, after just when it's been saying that the mission accomplished, so all the lies started floating around us piece by piece, and we don't know, it's too late now. Too late for anything to happen. So what is the legality of these things, how we stand from it and think? And I'm not an expert in that field, but this is something worth looking into it. And thank you very much.
Thank you
very much, Haifa.
Thank you very much, Haifa. For the latecomers, basically to frame the discussion that you're witnessing right now, the book is actually a transnational ethnography of one of the projects of the global anti-war movement that emerged against the occupation of Iraq in 2003. It was called the World Tribunal on Iraq, and it took place over 2 years in many cities around the world. And just to give you a sense of the extensiveness of the activist network that produced the World Tribunal on Iraq, let me just mention some of the cities where it happened. Barcelona, Brussels, Copenhagen, Frankfurt, Genoa, Istanbul, Lisbon, London, Mumbai, New York, Rome, Seoul, Stockholm, and in many cities of Japan. So you have hundreds and hundreds of activists who didn't know each other before, empowered by the global demonstrations against the war in Iraq, most spectacularly on February 15, 2003, coming together and saying, you know what? The victors of this war will not put themselves on trial. The International Criminal Court is not going to put the US and UK and all the other coalition forces on trial. What we will do is we're going to do it ourselves. We're going to form a global civil society tribunal to put the US and UK and other coalition forces on trial for the crimes that they are committing in waging an illegal and illegitimate war. And I make a great deal in the book, perhaps other speakers will address that, about the difference between political legitimacy and legality. So you have strangers speaking in their second or third language, being English, coming together, and Haifa, I'm very grateful for raising the point I tried to raise, perhaps insufficiently in the book, about the participation of Iraqis in the tribunal. So this is the overall framework, and by doing an ethnography of the World Tribunal on Iraq, a network ethnography, I address the debates internal to this activist network and map the stakes of these debates onto political philosophy, disagreements among international lawyers about the philosophy of international law, about political theory, and etc. So I'll just say that before we go on with the discussion to be able to situate it a little bit more. Thank you very much, Haifa.
Lori, go for it.
So from the outset, I'd like to say that Aita's book was very vexing for me. So that's the first thing I want to talk about, since I think the way that the book vexes and troubles is one of its greatest strengths. The second thing I want to reflect on is the investigative nature of the World Tribunal's mission. It's a crucial feature of what the Tribunal did and what international law generally is doing these days. And I think there's some urgency to the question of what are the presumptions about politics embedded in fact-finding missions, whether by global citizens like those that are featured in Aicha's book or by the UN. So I want to thank Aicha for including me in this conversation, because there are people who come at these questions from really fantastically different but important angles, and I'm keen to hear what they have to say too. But before I get into this, I want to point out a few things about the book that were not vexing, but in fact very pleasing. It's an elegantly written and argued text, and it seamlessly weaves ethnography and political philosophy in a very challenging but still comprehensible way. And maybe most remarkable is how the book captures this unique moment that Haifa was talking about, and the story of a group of people who were so creative and so incredibly thoughtful in their efforts to think beyond the existing nation-state system and its laws and its wars. As Aicha notes, the World Tribunal had the audacity to question the authority of international law and its compromised institutions. And the imagination and excitement that people invested in this process really comes through in the ethnography, and that's what ethnography can do. And these people also questioned who has the responsibility to protect and under what conditions. As Aicha's account shows, the so-called R2P doctrine takes a whole new valence when self-styled global citizens take their own responsibility to protect seriously. And the implications of these questions created my own consternation. So I return to what vexes me about this book, and that's the lack of an answer to the question of, so what are we to do? And my vexation is not Aicha's fault. Prescription is evidently not her purpose. Troubling her readers is, causing pause for thought. And for that reason, it's a book worth picking up and reading carefully. And even if there are no answers, the questions are critical. Who has the responsibility to protect? Or put more simply, when can we try to help them? And does the we-them-help triangle always and necessarily partake in systems of domination? And these are questions about the bases of acting in solidarity. The questions in this book prompt critical thought beyond the standard approaches to international law. I found, again, this is a vexation and a provocation in the book, Aicha disrupts any assumptions not only about the benevolence of human rights in ways that are... She disrupts the notion that human rights are benevolent good in ways that go beyond the standard leftist critiques of human rights, beyond the idea that humanitarianism is instrumentalized by governments to intervene in other countries. The issue is not just the imperial foundations of international law, but the imperial foundations of doing good for others in the name of humanity, generally by anyone. So forget powerful governments. When can I or you act on behalf of people who we see as being wronged? And one possible answer to this question that didn't seem to be discussed much by the World Tribunal is when you're invited. Mm-hmm. There's a question, I think, should they have asked for an invitation to do what they did? Did they need to be invited? Perhaps another answer is when you will be affected by these benevolent actions in the same ways as those on whose behalf you're acting, when you really all have the same things at stake. Right? So this isn't just a matter of falling back into conventional notions of nation-state sovereignty and who is the national people who has the supposed right to take decisions, but a matter of practical consequence. So I'd be curious to know more about what Iraqis who lived with, not just the folks in the tribunal, but Iraqis living with the effects of Saddam Hussein and the war and the American occupation, what they thought about all of this. To what extent did the tribunal speak with and to the concerns of the Iraqis who did not only live through the war, but also lived in Iraq before the war under sanctions, right? As a colleague and student here at the LSE pointed out to me, Hanin Amna, This is important because many Iraqis initially supported a foreign intervention, since they felt they were under siege during Hussein's regime. So what happens when the targets of our solidarity, when our solidarity efforts run counter to the opinions and beliefs and political projects of the people we're supposedly acting in solidarity with, when we don't share political opinion? And I wonder why this was not more central to the tribunal discussions. And Aicha starts to get at this in the book, but I still find it perplexing. Finally, and I'll end here in a minute, I want to draw attention to the three investigative tasks that the tribunal set for itself: to investigate the crimes committed by the U.S. government in launching the Iraq War, to investigate allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity, and the third, to consider the broader context of the doctrines of preemptive war. And I'd like to pause on this impulse to investigate. Investigative commissions and fact-finding missions have become a reflex reaction of the international community in recent years. In the Middle East, currently the UN has investigations running in Syria, Palestine, and Yemen, and such commissions have been set up all over the place, finding evidence of human rights violations, humanitarian law violations in everywhere from the Congo, Sri Lanka, Burundi, Libya, Gaza, and the commission from Myanmar investigating the Rohingya crisis has just issued its report naming that violence genocide. In general, these commissions try to remind the powers that be that they have signed on to agreements like the Geneva Conventions, which are supposed to help protect civilians during times of war, during armed conflict, and put boundaries on the acceptable use of force. So these investigations find evidence of the violation of these agreements, reassert these agreements through reports. But the siege on Gaza continues. And after 17 UN investigative reports on Syria, there are still some 5.5 million refugees, 6.5 million displaced persons. So this begs the question, what are investigations for? And my question more fundamentally, and I mean the UN and people's investigations, and my question more fundamentally is, what really are the effects of facts? In a world of non-representative governments and imploding and exploding nation states, what really is the power of knowledge, like the knowledge that this tribunal tried to put forward? What is the power of knowledge today? The World Tribunal may have tried to, quote, inform the public about the crimes against peace, war crimes, about the real goals behind this war. But until we, the people, can impose meaningful accountability on politicians, it could be that these are just more facts and findings for posterity. And so what I really want is for Aicha to write a sequel to this book, to understand No Rest for the Wicked, right? To understand the effects of the tribunal's incredible experiment and trace where their facts got them, where it did and didn't lead them, and the rest of the world, maybe so it can be done better next time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Four. Thank you. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold, so I may splutter and wheeze a bit. So it's an incredibly rich book, as we've heard, and I think the richness is seen in the way that we can have five people here approaching the book and touching on completely different issues, I think, that speak to our own work and interests. So I was struck in reading the book by what I think is a central tension at both the heart of the book and the tribunal itself. And Aicha really brings this out in discussing, for instance, the way that the tribunal came to be formed and the various parties and individuals who were interested and who gathered at various places in the world to discuss what this tribunal would do and what its foundation, what its basis of legitimacy, for instance, would be. And so that is, Aicha describes it as in various different terms, but it's essentially this idea of a legitimacy based on international law or legality and one on more something more political, right? Which is itself a problematic distinction, right? That law is somehow apolitical. And yet it's an assumption that is very much at the heart of many of the parties involved and their approach to this. So we see this tension even at the most basic level of what was the purpose of this tribunal. So For some participants, to quote Neischertz, the principal objective of telling and disseminating the truth about the Iraq War. So some sort of truth-telling, established some sort of historical record. On the other hand, there were those who thought that the tribunal had to do something more fundamental, rooted in a basis of legality, of international law, to use the term, that, without ascribing this view to you, the term that you just used when you interjected, to put the coalition on trial, to establish the illegality as well as the illegitimacy of the war. Now, importantly, Aisha points out that the illegality and the illegitimacy of the war are not necessarily the same thing. So we see this idea of the legal, without having been there, it's hard we have to trust you, your representation of this, but the picture that comes away is at these preparatory meetings, we have these participants, many of whom are lawyers, or if not lawyers, certainly invested in a legalistic approach to the world, and those more, let's say, grassroots organizers, participants in a long tradition of anti-imperialist movements, and they often speak at odds and in tension to one another. So we have, Aisha says, the legalists wished international law to be the sole mother tongue of the nascent World Tribunal on Iraq, whereby the tribunal would not only express but also perceive facts through categories of international law, organizing reality through the discourse of law. And so for them, the legitimacy of the tribunal would come from law itself, right? What we were going to do is establish, using these established legal categories, international legal categories of war crimes, of crimes of aggression, and so on. This was the metric against which we would judge the legitimacy of the war. And as well, the legitimacy would come from using legal procedures. This was to be a trial, as you put it. And so if a trial is to be fair, it can't be a show trial. It must be a trial that follows prescribed procedures that ensure fairness and so on. On the other hand, we have others who were quite skeptical of international law, from my own perspective, rightly so. So here we have a body of norms and international rules and institutions that their history shows are inherently wrapped up with imperialism itself. So it's quite odd, perverse even, for anti-imperialists to advance an anti-imperialist agenda on the back of what is essentially an imperialist order and institutions. So was the World Tribunal of on Iraq to be simply an appendage of international legal institutions? Certainly, there was much talk, we learned from Aisha's book, that the ICC specifically should be the model for the World Tribunal on Iraq. So not only international law sort of as providing the normative framework for judging the war, but also that this tribunal should model itself on a particular specific subfield of international law, namely international criminal law. Right? And again, this seems somewhat perverse to an institution such as the ICC, which its short history shows is inherently wrapped up with furthering the interests of imperial states, that should be the model for judging an act of imperialism. And yet, this tension plays out, what's interesting, I think, or what really struck me, was that this same tension can already be found in the Russell Tribunal, right? So I should spend some time discussing and showing how the World Tribunal in Iraq drew on a long tradition of citizens' tribunals or people's tribunals, going back to the original Russell Tribunal the Russell War Crimes Tribunal on Vietnam. And so there was already a tension. So it was established by Bertrand Russell, but also prominent in the tribunal was Sartre. And already there, if we look at the history of the Russell Tribunal, there were some tensions between Russell and Sartre, or at least between the groups around them. So Russell was very much interested that the tribunal should be, to quote him, the most exhaustive portrayal of what has happened to the people of Vietnam. We intend that the peoples of the world shall be aroused as never before, the better to prevent the repetition of this tragedy elsewhere. He said the tribunal should record the truth in Vietnam. He hoped to arouse anger in the West and to galvanize opposition to the war. On the other hand, Sartre and the group in France around Sartre were much more concerned with invoking international law and the legality of the war in Vietnam, an idea that was largely absent from political discourse at the time. So if we think of the popular protests against the Iraq war, we see, you know, protesters holding signs saying send Bush and Blair to The Hague and so on, right? And that this is the war was illegal. It's a fundamentally ambiguous question whether the war was even illegal. Many assume it was, but I mean, all sort of critical international legal scholarship of the last several decades has shown that international law is fundamentally indeterminate. And even if it was illegal, the fact that five imperial states in the Security Council could agree theoretically that it wasn't illegal, that would then deem it perfectly legal, and would our opposition to the invasion of Iraq be any, would it evaporate simply because now it was a legal imperialist venture? So in contrast, in Vietnam, or rather in the US and Europe, in opposition to the Vietnam War, one found very few invocations of law or international law as the reason why this was an illegitimate venture, right? An illegitimate war. As late as 1965, Henry Cabot Lodge, the U.S. ambassador in Saigon, could tell reporters, as far as I'm concerned, the legal aspects of the war is of no significance. So what happened between Vietnam and Iraq that international law could become so central to the anti-imperialist movement and so central to this tribunal in particular, the Iraq tribunal? And to some extent, we have the Russell Tribunal to blame, right? That was the start of this. So we have Sartre, in opposition to the sort of Russell statements, opposition is too strong a word, but in contradistinction, we find him saying that, you know, there's no question of judging whether American policy in Vietnam is evil. Evil is a problematic term, but let's say illegitimate. Of this, most of us have not the slightest doubt, Sartre said. The task of the tribunal, however, for Sartre was narrower. It was to determine the legality of that policy and its concomitant actions. Do they fall specifically, to quote Sartre, within the compass of international law on war crimes? So the Russell Tribunal placed the question of the war's legality squarely in the public eye, with its insistence that the war was not only morally reprehensible, but criminal. And such an association, Sartre in particular had felt, was important in arousing opposition amongst what he called the petite bourgeois masses, who were indifferent to the necessity, crime or no crimes, of the struggle against imperialism. It is by means of legalism, he believed, that their eyes can be opened. The juridification of war over the following decades and the overinvestment, I would argue, in international law of today's anti-war movement, to the extent one even exists, might, in hindsight, have given him pause.
Thank you very much, Tor.
Okay. I guess it's a testimony to the richness of this book that so many people coming from so many different directions can find so many things in it. I'm myself looking at this simultaneously as an anthropologist and as a work of ethnography, and at the same time as someone who's been involved in a lot of activist projects, which, while not, you know, on the same global and legal framework, have faced sort of similar constitutive problems. So, you know, to me, it raises a really different set of questions. First of all, I want to remark what a beautiful ethnography it is. And I was really impressed by the richness and sensitivity because, well, it's not that long, but it includes an awful lot. To be honest, a lot more than most ethnographies, which often are rather thin on social movements. And I thought this was brought home some really fundamental questions. And in a way, I think what this book is ultimately about is perhaps the most important both political and social theoretical question one can ask, which is the basic question of who are we to judge? That is to say, and hence I'd like to make a few remarks, especially about the notion of humanity. The book is for the love of humanity, and it sort of circles around the question of humanity and how do you constitute a moral order which gives you the right to say that something that you feel deeply and profoundly is wrong, that you actually have a basis to say that is objectively wrong, which is sort of the question that everyone faces who has tried to engage in social action of one kind or another. It seems like a transparently simple thing, and you look at something that's outrageous and should never happen, and you... John Holloway famously writes about The Scream. He says, you know, we don't come at these things from a theory. We say, well, there is such a thing as justice. It would be like, oh, that must be wrong. You know, you start by saying, oh, my God, you know, this is so horrible. And then you try to develop your theory around that spontaneous reaction. But, you know, the moment you try to do it and give it a basis, you end up with all these slippery problems that always seem to come up. And one of the key ones is, like, you know, who are we to object to begin with? And the more epistemologically radical you become when trying to solve this problem, the more it becomes actually difficult to sustain a politically radical position. It's an endless paradox, which is explored very beautifully in a lot of the debates and conversations here. So I think the notion of humanity, you know, in when reading this, really made me think that you're judging in the name of humanity, and this seems like the obvious thing to do if you're trying to assemble a global network. But in doing so, you know, humanity is a very difficult thing to define, and I know that Aicha has been thinking about this a great deal theoretically in very interesting ways. But I wanted to throw in my own reflections on this I came to my realization at one point that humanity, it's not just something that is violated. You know, when people are victimized, it's an assault on humanity. But, you know, you can say you are outraged at assaults on nature, on animals, on things that are not human. But you can't, you can condemn someone for an assault on something that's not human. But you can't condemn something that isn't human for an assault. So, in fact, humanity is by definition something that could be guilty or could be blamed. And thus you're adopting a certain moral status, but by saying that, which is strangely ambivalent, you're placing things in a moral community of potential judgment, which must necessarily also fall on yourself. And the question is the basis on which you do that. I've faced this problem in practical ways. Whenever I've been part of a group, the question always comes up when you try to organize something: who are we anyway? My most vivid experience of this was in the early days of Occupy, when, you know, we were presented with this thing where we were going to, it was announced as something we were going to make some demand. The first question, which we didn't really want to do, but we ended up in this long debate about, well, who would we make a demand in the name of anyway? Who the hell are we? And this always is a moment that occurs when you're in, you know, trying to talk about social justice, recognize something that terrible is going on. And in a way, the one thing that most everybody remembers out of Occupy is the solution we came up to that, which was like, why don't we just call ourselves the 99%? And the interesting thing was that it caught on in a certain way, and it made me think, when you talk about the political versus the legal basis. You know, people talked about the effervescence that came of all the demonstrations against the war. We're speaking in the name of whatever that thing is that seemed to be emerging. And people like Tony Negri at the time were talking about there is a global empire, a sort of kind of global sovereignty, and that emerging from that was what he called the multitude, you know, these networks of cooperation that exist around the world. He's just trying to name a revolutionary subject. On what moral basis can we say we object to something? Who are we that we have the right to say that something else is wrong? And enter into the same moral community as that which we're opposing. And it strikes, and you know, I think a lot of people have kind of come to realize that that formulation didn't really work. But I think the most it was what everybody was talking about at the time. It didn't quite come together over the long term. But I think the enduring element of that is the notion of prophecy, which is something that people don't talk about so much about the way he formulated it. His politics was based in Spinoza, and Spinoza had this very interesting notion that you know, the Hebrew nation was essentially invented by the Hebrew prophets. And you invent a people that can make moral claims by prophecy isn't about predicting something so much as placing yourself in time in a moral narrative. And it's by doing that, he says, well, you know, you organize the desires of the multitude is the way that he puts it. But what he's talking about seems to be something about what's happening when people speak in the name of humanity. You are constituting something that doesn't exist but could exist if, as part of the very motion of creating it. And that motion necessarily, if you look at what prophets do, they always talk about bearing testimony to suffering, misery, and injustice as part of that larger narrative by which you constitute a subject. And it's something interesting to think about because, again, speaking as an anthropologist, you know, the origins of sovereignty itself is a much mooted topic. I've recently written a book about this very topic, which doesn't really solve the problem, but I think at least sets it out that political, as Kloster, Lowy, and Kloster, and people like that have long ago pointed out, political orders in most stateless societies we know are set up so that a state can't emerge. There are checks and balances in there. Insofar as it is possible to break through those barriers that are set up to prevent sovereignty from emerging, sovereignty is essentially contained in the cosmic realm. You know, prophets appeal to a something beyond the human, which then constitutes us reflectively as humans, as humanity. And you know, so there are kings in the heavens before there are on earth, clearly, as Marshall Solons keeps pointing out. And it's only the act of prophecy that actually brought sovereignty to earth to begin with. This is something that Kloster himself, you know, concluded when he was trying to understand how the state could possibly break through all the barriers that were created. So there is always that moment of realization, of desire, of testimony to suffering and injustice, and a vision of a sort of cosmic future, which is necessarily part of the creation of any subject which can constitute itself as a basis of sovereignty. And I think this is the best anthropological way to think about what's happening here. Mm-hmm. I wanted to throw that out as a framework.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. And last, but far from least, Professor Hutchings.
It feels a bit like least after coming after such interesting contributions. And I'd like to echo what people have already said in terms of this being a very interesting and thought-provoking, and I love Laurie's word, vexing book in many respects. For me, the fact that there is no easy message that comes out of this book is its great strength. There are no goodies and baddies, even though there is actually, I think, a great deal of love in the portrayal of the tribunal and how people approach it. So, you know, this is written with empathy, but also with the capacity to stand back and actually appreciate the political dynamics, the paradoxes, the problems of the ways in which people were trying to constitute themselves as a political subject. So it's fascinating in the way in which it delineates all of those tensions. And one of the things that it shows is how, largely because of the prevalence of the discourses of international law, the dynamics that on the one hand, Deutsche shows us are part of the broader justifications and arguments about the Iraq war, are reflected within the World Tribunal on Iraq processes, raising the question really of whether the love for humanity can ever be innocent, or even perhaps in its more extreme form, whether the love for humanity is necessarily mired in violence. And I think that's a question that you raise, and I'd be interested to hear you say more about that. Near the beginning of the book, Aicha poses the following question. How can we distinguish the cosmopolitan ethos of responsibility and solidarity that grounded the legitimacy of the World Tribunal on Iraq from the cosmopolitan ethos that conferred legitimacy ex ante or ex post facto to the constitution of the liberated Iraq? I mean, that is a very hard-hitting question, and I think her answer is that essentially you can't, or that it's very difficult to do so, although there may be strands in terms of the legitimacy of the World Tribunal that do give us an alternative. I think maybe that's not entirely clear in the book, but it's perhaps a possibility. I think she shows the entanglement of these discourses with each other, discourses about legitimacy within the tribunal with discourses about the legitimacy of the war. She shows that entanglement in many different ways, particularly vividly in the parallel discussion of debates over the legitimacy of the tribunal, where its legitimacy comes from, how it's constituted as a political subject, and so on, and the divided response within it to the new constitution that is set up after the occupation of Iraq, which is treated as a fact that has to be worked with regardless of the criminal and violent origins of it by various human rights actors, and the tribunal has to try and sort of grapple with that. So you have that discussion at the same time as you have a discussion of the tribunal that sat in judgment of Saddam Hussein, and again of the responses to that. And I think that's an incredibly powerful unpacking of law and of politics simultaneously, extremely interesting, interestingly so. So during the course of the book, there's a series of fascinating insights into the internal dilemmas of network politics, of coalitional politics, and we've heard something about that already from other speakers. Aicha, in some sense, gives us sort of dilemmas or debates between political versus legal ways of thinking about legitimacy. She also touches on very interesting issues about the difference between the politics of a network as opposed to the politics of a party. And there's some good stuff also on decision making and consensus, and ways in which voices come to prominence within movements versus a kind of abdication of speaking, the refusal of signatures, the use of silence. So there's some really, really interesting fine-grained stuff about how the politics of protest, the politics of trying to hold imperial power to account works. And as I say, there's a great deal of love in that delineation. Ultimately, I read the book as a political theorist, and I suppose I am most interested in what seems to me the really major political and moral questions that it raises. So I just want to finish with three sort of areas that I think are really important in terms of what Aicha is talking about. The question of the imperialism of international law, whether that imperialism is always the same. So although we may see similarities, is it always the same in the ways that different parties will utilize the discourse of international law for different purposes? Can international law be decolonized? Is that something that would be possible? And what place might a politics of human rights have in this decolonization? Because I think it's interesting in the book that human rights come out very much placed with, as it were, the legalists within the tribunal. And yet there's also a way of thinking about human rights that is much more about it as a politics. And if one looks at the way that notions of human rights are used and worked with politically in different parts of the world, then it's clear that the legal story may not be the only story as far as discourses of human rights are concerned. At some points, there's a suggestion that maybe we need a move from the global to the international in terms of thinking about how to work for those who are oppressed or to speak on behalf of those who are injured by the current world order. But I don't know. I'm interested in the way that our historical moment has shifted since the moment that Aicha is writing about, so that in a world in which it was quite clear that there was a liberal imperialist project going on, are we still in that world in quite the same way? Could international law be rather more radical in a contemporary context in which powerful states want to detach themselves from international regimes than in a situation in which international regimes become the way in which powerful states establish themselves? I don't think there's a single answer to that, but I do think there is an issue about historical moment here and about what's radical when, which goes back to the question of whether the imperialism of international law is always the same. The second area that I thought was really helpful in the book, and which follows a lot of work that other people do, people like Tarek have done, for example, is about the distinction between war and policing and the ways in which that distinction simply does not hold. And I think that emerged really, really powerfully here. And I think, you know, the idea that there is validity within that distinction is really, really well questioned here. And I think that's something that we need to take extremely seriously, especially those of us like me who engage with literatures like the literatures of just war theory and the ethics of war. And I suppose the third thing that I take out of the book, or that I would, you know, I'm interested in terms of the big questions, is precisely that ethics of war question. Aicha raises the classic means end issue, you know. Is it possible to use violence and war in order to achieve good ends? She doesn't really answer it, I don't think. I would like to suggest that it should be answered in such a way as to say, no, you can't, and it's better not to, and to think of the movement against war as the movement against war and not simply a particular war. And I will finish there.
Okay, I'm going to take a first pass through the audience to collect two or three comments or questions, and then I'm going to give Aicha a chance to respond to some of the comments that she's heard, and then I'll give you all a chance to engage a little bit in the discussion, and then we'll come back to you. So who'd like to start off? Please, in the back there.
Hi, Latif Taş from SOAS, University of London. Congratulations, Aicha, first of all, and I haven't read the book, and I'm looking forward to read very soon. My question is, when we look at 2003 and after what's happened, like 15 years almost has passed, and there was war, and the United Kingdom and United States also, they committed, and it was discussed by the war tribunal on Iraq, but there was also resistance against, you know, increasing of resistance, which is from Fallujah, from Mosul, and this resistance has turned and create the foundation of the ISIS. And, you know, and my question is how much the war tribunal on Iraq during that times, all these sessions and countries has acknowledged this kind of uprising of danger as well. When we criticize one side, how much we glorify it or create a glorification for another side, which also turn into another monster.
Okay, thank you very much. Another one or two? Come on. When I go away from you, I won't come back for a bit. Please.
Lies, statements made without an honest belief or a reasonable belief in their truth. They should be criminalized, shouldn't they? nationally and internationally, in if they're said in the public domain, of course, with surrounding considerations. But I've heard terribly little about this, and yet the Iraq War was the beginning. It wasn't, of course, the beginning of lies, but it was of a trend to lying, 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 lying. Of course, politicians have got to bring these things into force.
Thank you. One more comment.
Maybe upstairs?
No. I've been looking upstairs. Come on. I know it's hard to break into these conversations when you haven't read the book, but they've given you a lot to work with. What's something burning in someone's head? Preferably, there we go. Thank you very much. Right over here. Wait for the mic. Wait for the mic. Go for
it. Not really. It's just more of a practical question. I just want to know, like, the demographics of the sessions that both you and Haifa went to. You know, who was there, what the demographics like, mm-hmm. gender, obviously. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Aicha.
Okay. Let me start with the factual question, Laurie, mm-hmm. about who was there. Maybe Haifa can respond to that, the composition of the sessions for she's been to. I went to the session in Brussels, Istanbul, and a few sessions in Japan, and the one in Mumbai, and the one in, there was an event in Paris. It wasn't necessarily a tribunal session. First of all, it was, I could say easily that the organization of the tribunal, especially in Istanbul, was very much led by women. To such an extent that it was said that this is the creation of women, this tribunal. In terms of, again, my focus will be on Istanbul because it was the most important session. It was the culminating session where the whole global network came together. It was very international. So there were observers, participants, 54 participants from all around the world. There was a jury of conscience, some 13 different countries. The spokesperson of the jury of conscience was Arundhati Roy, the Indian novelist and activist. The spokesperson of the panel of advocates was Professor Richard Falk, an important international lawyer. And overall, it was very diverse. But I do say, especially in the afterword of the book, that what I find in retrospect, unfortunately, very significant is the lack of Iraqi participation in it. During the process of imagining the tribunal. Yes, there were participants from Iraq at the founding meeting, about which I write at great length, but I read it as a symptom of a certain cosmopolitanism that, going back to Laurie's comments, that doesn't quite care about the desires of the people that it wants to be in solidarity with. So there was that strand. And I mind you, whatever I'm saying here is about segments of the activists, because the coalition, the network that came together to make the World Tribunal on Iraq was so diverse ideologically. Yes, I don't only mean internationally, gender-wise, class-wise, etc. Although class... maybe it was petit bourgeois. I shouldn't be quoted on this. But it was so ideologically diverse. There were internationalists, I would say, more close to the 1967 moment. That they were definitely talking about national self-determination, and they were talking about international solidarity with a particular nation, the Iraqi nation, that was being occupied by imperial forces. Yet there were others that were not necessarily talking about the Iraqi nation in particular. They were talking about humanity and the responsibilities of humanity to stand in solidarity. I have a paragraph or two about this, which I thought very hard about, where I say at certain moments it felt as if Iraq was an example or what the bad guys, the imperialists, did. It was as if Iraq and its particularities did not quite matter. It was an instantiation of what the bad guys, the imperialists, did. So in the name of anti-imperialism, we had to be against this war. In the name of humanity, we had to be against this war. Yet somehow, at certain moments, I'm not talking about, of course, it's called the World Tribunal on Iraq, yet out of the concepts of the world and the tribunal, Iraq was the least conceptualized, and its paradoxes and its contradictions taken least seriously as a problem. And going back to Latif's question too, there was the image and importance of the Iraqi resistance. There was the discourse of the tribunal, the final conclusions are full of the discourse of the Iraqi resistance. At the founding meeting in October 2003, in the constitutive imagination of the tribunal, one of the sources of legitimacy is listed as the Iraqi people resisting the occupation is a source of legitimacy for this tribunal. The thinking behind was that the fact that Iraqi people don't want this occupation grounds our own right acting in the name of humanity to question the justness of this occupation. Because first and foremost, Iraqis are questioning it. There was also recognition, however, that Iraqis as such wasn't a unified category. There were very elaborate debates and discussions about this. Who do we mean when we say the people of Iraq? There were extensive debates about even the terminology being used. Shall we say peoples of Iraq, plural, or people of Iraq? Shall we be talking about Arabs and Kurds and Turkmens, or shall we be talking about a singular national body? So that's some of the work I tried to do in the book by showing how even a debate over the singular or plural form of the concept people reflects a deep thinking. Yet nevertheless, I read it as a problematic lightheartedness embedded in a certain cosmopolitanism that non-intentionally erases or tends to erase the particularity of those who you are being in solidarity with. And that's a problem. And going back to Kim's comment about perhaps the book suggests we should return to some older form of internationalism, I know you didn't say I said it, but I don't say it. But that sense is justified because I was thinking very hard, okay, if this kind of cosmopolitanism is problematic, if we are not one humanity undivided by relations of power, etc., then what is the alternative? Then how can we imagine the globe? How can we imagine who lives around the world, the collective subject, the prophetic subject that David was talking about, that we're trying to bring into being, if it is not to be thought in terms of nations, as in internationalism, as in the Vietnam anti-war movement, we're in solidarity with the people of Vietnam, as the, say, the French Communist Party. But this was different. 2003-05 was different. And this is why I think the organizing concept at that moment was humanity in 2003-2005, much more so than it was in 1967 when you had a more old school type of internationalist solidarity. So I tried to cover everything. A number of points.
Do any of you want to come back, make some comments either for the audience or to Aicha? Please.
Actually, most of what Aicha was talking about reflects also on the dilemmas we went through as Iraqis. There was a big problem we faced. And I'm talking about the group of people who were for the World Tribunal. Mm-hmm. Because we had people didn't believe in the World Tribunal at that time. They thought, well, we had to persuade them that this is a solidarity, and they thought they were saying, but we are the occupied. What is kind of solidarity you're talking about? We cannot solidarity with ourselves. So we have this argument about it. We are the occupied. The other side, so immediately created we and them, although we were within the same movement, that thing. So our task was almost to persuade them that this is about documenting the crimes in the hope in the future that will be a legal action in order to help the US, the UK, Tony Blair, Bush, whoever committed this war of aggression to be held responsible. That took us some time and still is actually with any kind of solidarity movement. It's a big issue for us, especially for the people who came out from Iraq and they were at the receiving end of all kind of atrocities and they looking at their streets and all their streets occupied by the tanks and the Apache in the air. So it is very difficult to persuade people who can find it very difficult to breathe that this is going to sort out your problem. It took really some time to persuade them that this is not a theater, another theater or an act of theaters to be taking place around the world for people who are having the luxury of enjoying themselves and talking about legality and the other than that. I think this is one of the things we still live with, actually, for Iraqis. So it is, we still seek. And we had some hope also. I mean, continuity of the World Tribunal did not finish at that because we had the session of the Kuala Lumpur in 2011. And Mahathir Mohamed was the president of that. And Richard Falk, again, himself went there and worked on. And at this time, actually, they got to the point that they have to record, they have to employ lawyers, international lawyers, in order to present this case of Iraq, the crime committed against Iraq and Iraqi people, to be presented to the ICC at that time. I mean, it didn't work in the end because it costs so much and it's going through, again, conflicts here and there, and that's that. Mm-hmm. But I think what looks like a dream for us at that time, it has like any major movement, whether it is in art, in literature, in politics, in international law, it will not diminish completely. It will continue. Various faces, various steps, but it will be up to the people themselves, people like us, how they can carry, how they can change, how they deal with it. And the morality of it, it's clear for us. It's never been questionable. Really, we did not go into any question about who is... it was very clear. This is a colonial power. We've been through this before in Iraq, and it's been repeated again. First by the British, second by the American and the British. Third, who knows by who, what. So it is a continuous, a clear path, actually, which is maybe sounds naive, but for us it was a clear path of occupying Iraq for reasons we know very well what they are. We didn't go into minor details at that time, which then might be very important, extremely important.
Laurie's question about facts and lies is still yes. hanging in the air. So are there any other comments? David, are you looked on the verge of saying something there?
Oh, no, I was trying to figure something out. I haven't quite got there yet.
I have something to say. When Haifa was saying we know very well we didn't go into this, it made me think mm-hmm. back to Tor's comment about legality. What's striking to me is, and David, back to you, and Kim, also back to you, about the big questions. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to me that millions of people opposed the occupation of Iraq because it was illegal.
Yeah.
They later, when they were expressing their opposition to the war, said, stop this criminal war. There is a difference between the two. One is about motivation for opposing something that is unfolding in front of your eyes. it's a different matter when you're trying to make a account of it, give an account of it to the world. So I think the World Tribunal on Iraq is just an example of a political movement that struggled to give an account of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And to give an account of itself in terms that were not necessarily legalistic. Mm. So I want to pose the question to Tor. I mean, what was different about 1967? You mentioned in your comments that perhaps the language they were using was less legalistic than the World Tribunal on Iraq's.
Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today? It's a different language.
It is a different language. Although we had that in
the more or less.
The Bush
more
version. Yes, we had the Bush version in 2003. Yeah.
But the Bush version was followed up with, and therefore you should be prosecuted.
Yes.
I know. This is, yes, exactly. And I see this as a problem that our politics, and now I will come out because in the book I try very hard not to take a side between, I don't know, my readers may comment, do I succeed or not? I try very hard to present the legalist perspectives with as much sympathy as the political perspectives. But if you ask me, I mean, to me it's very problematic that politics has increasingly in global affairs is coming to be expressed in terms of law, in terms of legality and illegality. Why? Have we lost other languages to express our objection to a certain policy? Why is the popularity of international law so prevalent? Mm-hmm. And in the 21st century, I am afraid this is not going to go away. Since 2005, international law has continued to colonize. But going back to Kim's question, perhaps that's not necessarily a bad thing, I heard you say, in this particular moment.
In this moment. Yeah.
In this particular moment, in your challenge to Tor's comments. Is it?
I was just going to say, I think context is crucially important, but I also think international law isn't perhaps as monolithic as maybe is being presented here, in that it operates in lots of different ways and in lots of different contexts. But also it's very open to interpretation. So actually what people read into international law is going to be different at different times as well. I mean, I think it does, I think you do justice to all sides of the argument, but I do think actually that it emerges somewhat that you are perhaps not entirely happy with the legalism. But I think it's a really interesting question to pose. Something about there being an assumption that there's a sort of self-evidence about law being somehow right. You know, that whole rhetoric of law having an awful lot of power and having acquired more power. And I'm not entirely sure why that is, because I don't think it's just about international law. I think it's more broadly.
True. Yeah.
But it's a kind of shortcut for thought, isn't it? You don't have to actually engage with what the reasons might be. You just have to think in terms of, is it legal or
illegal?
Yeah.
Criminal or non-criminal.
Yeah, which is not. Yeah, which is not.
Well, Laurie, and then, is this right on this, David?
Oh, yeah. No, I was going to say that I think that's the obvious immediate appeal of appeal to law is an appeal to the hypocrisy of the powerful. You know, so it's very hard when you see people acting in violation of what they claim to be their own principles not to throw it in their face. But at the same time, in doing so, you get drawn into a discourse which assumes that, you know, some sort of high overarching authority is appropriate. What I thought was interesting is to contrast the discourse of law with that of solidarity itself, which is not a legal concept at all. I mean, nobody has a legal obligation to solidarity with anybody. In a way, it transcends and violates, and, you know, it's that which goes beyond any sort of legal obligation you have. I mean, one would even say, since solidarity is sort of recognizing other people's needs as legitimate in themselves and, you know, in relation not only to your own ability rather than to their ability to exchange or answer it. You know, it's almost the political substance of international communism, you could say, as communism is from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. It's a fundamentally different constitutive principle of society than one based on law and in direct conflict with it, in a way.
Okay, I'm conscious of time, and I want to get one more round there. So Tor and Lori, and then I'll come to you, and then we'll get you'll get the last word. Go ahead. I thought this was on the, same. Yeah.
So I was just going to say that I think it's easy to overstate the sort of withdrawal at this present juncture from international law by powerful states, right? So there's a lot of bluster and rhetoric, and there's some key multilateral treaties that particular states might pull back from. But the same bluster and rhetoric was there in the early Bush years. Mm-hmm. And for all of the sort of key, you know, withdrawals from particular treaties, the Bush administration and even the Trump administration continues to make sure to justify everything that they do in the language of international law. So behind the scenes, every airstrike is there's a public statement by lawyers saying, actually, on our interpretation of international law, this is true of Israel. It's very popular for liberal international lawyers to say this is clearly illegal, but actually there are very careful, extensive legal analyses and arguments, justifications, and it's not easy to just say that's wrong, because actually there's international law is indeterminate and one can make these arguments, and so I think it's easy to overstate that. Yeah. I think
there's a reason the Pentagon has thousands of lawyers,
right. Yeah. Which is itself a development since the Vietnam age, right? That the juridification of war, and that arguably has not made war less inhumane, but merely provided a vocabulary to justify the inhumanity. So I was just going to, one other point, sure, just in terms quick. Of the, so there's the problem of international law on the one hand, but with this tribunal, or the tribunals in general, there's an additional factor, if you put aside the concerns of legality, with the invocation of a particular type of law, right, international criminal law.
Yeah.
And the idea of the trial. And the very nature of international criminal law is that it individualizes responsibility for atrocity. Right? It's all about we can stop future atrocities happening by holding individuals to account and punishing individual perpetrators. But in doing so, it sort of creates an ideological closure to all of the structural forces behind those individuals, right? So the Iraq War didn't happen because Bush is an evil man. It happened because of imperialism, capitalism, or whatever systemic forces you want to identify there. And so there's something particularly troublesome in anti-imperial movements invoking not just law, but or international law, but criminal, international criminal law, I think. And specifically, it's proceduralisms.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Lori, I'm sorry for letting
I'll let you toss
no,
it
no,
to
No, you audience. Go make your point. You've been waiting.
So what we're hearing about is the way in which international law has become a language of legitimization for different politics, including anti-imperial politics. We've also seen, and the book brings out, how international law became a channel for answering the question of who are we anyway, that David posed, that these folks at the tribunal were agonizing over. How do we legitimize what we're doing? How do we justify the bases on which we've come together to act in some way? And this is the available language. And Aicha asked, and lots of people have asked, why has international law become that channel now? And one possible answer, I think, is the demise of political parties. Mm. You don't have government officials and politicians agonizing about their legitimacy in any way near the degree to which the folks that Aicha portrays agonize about who are we that come together to make this political stance and make these political claims. And I think if there's a recognition that they're being political and they're coming together around a shared set of moral principles, and they can name themselves whatever they want to name themselves, but enough with the agonizing and get on with it. And I think international law is this language that, as you show, purports to offer a universality and neutrality that people think they need in order to do anything in the world. And that is obviously, I think, what needs to be shed, and which the book brings us to in a very neutral, I think, and delicate way.
Thank you, Lori. I saw someone burning over there. Please. Mm-hmm. There's going to be one up there. Do we have someone up there?
So, Mabruk Aicha.
Oh, thank you.
I have two questions, one related to the discussion and one not related to the current discussion. The first not related one, can you say a few words about the methodology mm-hmm. of investigating your own work? Because if I understand correctly, you were active in the tribunals.
Oh, yes.
So as the book shows, it can be done, but what are some of the problematics of investigating and studying yourself, in a way?
I don't recommend it.
And the other, just one other question, is I want to piggyback on Kimberly's question about the idea that the love of humanity is mired with violence. Mm. Because in a way, you take that part of the title from Hannah Arendt's For the Love of the World, and for her, that is not mired with violence. For you, I think it is. And love is not about law. You were talking here about law and how law can be violent. But love is, we don't usually think, at least, of love as being related to violence. So maybe talk a bit about the way.
Okay.
Thank you. Please.
Hi, I'm Elvina Hoffman, a PhD student at King's. Thank you very much for this fascinating discussion. I would also like to get back to some questions that Kim raised, and especially about the kind of dynamics of constituting the different demands and claims within the different sites that you investigated, and how they related to each other, or whether or not they affected each other, and how that feeds back to legality or legal norms. Does that have any effect on how these legal norms are constituted, reconstituted, rethought? So sort of problematizing this division that you suggested towards the end of the talk of politics and legality, but more looking at it as a form of struggle.
There we go. Go for it over here.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you about how far do you think the WTI was effective in achieving its goals, and what would be needed for it to achieve its full goals?
Yeah.
Up at the top there is a question.
Yeah.
Go for it, Rachel.
I'm Rachel. I'm a first-year PhD student here in IR, International Relations. And my question is more like a response. So I guess the language of international law is also used in not only in legitimizing the self, but also in the definition and representation of the other, that is terrorists, or the Iraqi government believed to be associated with the terrorism. So I guess the language of international law can be dated back to the Western tradition of individualism. So when we try to represent the other when we try to represent terrorism as a crime against humanity, and we hold the individual terrorists responsible and not the whole structure behind the terrorism or the structure of imperialism behind terrorism. So I guess that's the story of the other side, not only. It's not only happening in the legitimation of the self.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. One more.
Do we? We have 3 minutes.
I know.
That's it.
Politely.
Oh, okay.
We'll go a little over.
Okay.
Good, right here. That'll be the last.
Thank you. Paul McGrail, Pax Christi. On the subject of intervention or non-intervention, do you think it will ever be possible for, in an age when everything is tending away from multilateralism and international agreements and understanding, will it ever be possible for bodies to agree when a military intervention can be condoned, and if so, what is the tipping point, and who should it be done by?
Thank you. Aicha.
Oh.
Solve the problem of international order.
So, of humanity. Well, I'll have to pick one question because I have 1 minute. The methodology question is very important. I would like to, I mean, I take it for granted that I was an activist in the World Tribunal on Iraq processes. Sometimes I forget even to mention it. And if you haven't read the book, you wouldn't know that, because in the book I say I acted both as an anthropologist in this two-year process and as an activist. I mean, I was so active in it that I was on stage, you know, making... Haifa would testify to that. I was part of the contents committee of the final session in Istanbul. So how did that play out in terms of writing and publishing the book? It took me 10 years to negotiate the problems that came with it, because I also participated in political debates. I took a side. I said, no, that's wrong, this is right, etc. I was fully involved in it. And when everybody was done with the tribunal, I was left with the task of recording it and representing it. I don't say recording because I don't think one can simply record like a recorder. Obviously, this is a representation. But I was so concerned with doing justice to it that it took me a very long time to even be comfortable with putting it out in the world. I didn't interview anybody methodologically because I didn't want to create that object-subject relationship. I didn't want to say, what do you think you're doing here? This is a pure ethnography. It's purely based on my participation and observation, my sense of what was happening. Although I use meeting recordings, for example, I have a whole chapter on a three-day meeting through which the World Tribunal on Iraq was founded. I did the recordings. They were found useful, transcribed, shared with everybody. But I analyze actual transcripts and montage it together to try to make some sense of it. Love of humanity and violence. Is love non-violence?
Always violent.
Mm-hmm. I would say there is violence in love.
That's it.
Just think of your parents.
Shakespeare.
Okay, are you done?
Yeah.
Any burning comments? You guys?
Just a celebration of it.
We will. Yeah.
I just want to say in response to Aisha that you walk away from reading the book with this very paradoxical sort of feeling that at once, this is a work of sort of the appropriately detached ethnographer, right, very neutral, and yet one walks away also knowing that Aisha is a very committed scholar activist, and yet this shouldn't really work together, and yet it does. Yeah.
Thank you. Before you join me in thanking Aisha and the speakers, there will be a reception just across Houghton Street in the Lower Garrick. Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh. Columbia House underneath, there's a cafe there. And everybody is welcome. Please come and join us. All that's left to do is to thank our speakers and especially the author.